Hubbard had said that only 2.5% of the human population were suppressive. But one of the problems I faced in writing about Scientology, especially its early days, is that the preponderance of people who had been close to Hubbard had either quietly left the church or been declared suppressive. Some, like Pat Broker, had gone underground. Many others, like David Mayo, had signed non-disclosure agreements. Those who remained in the church were off limits to me. Footnote. At this point, Paul Haggis had not been declared suppressive. He later was. We discussed the allegations of abuse lodged by many former members against Miscavige. "The only people who will corroborate are their fellow apostates," Davis said. "They're a pack of sanctimonious liars." He produced affidavits from other Scientologists refuting their accusations. He noted that in the tales about Miscavige, the violence always seemed to come out of nowhere. One would think that if such a thing occurred, which it most certainly did not, there'd have to be a reason, Davis said. I had wondered about these outbursts as well. When Rinder and Rathbun were in the church, they claimed that allegations of abuse were baseless. Then, after Rinder defected, he said that Miscavige had beaten him 50 times. Rathbun had told the St. Petersburg Times in 1998 that in the 20 years he had worked closely with Miscavige, he had never seen him hit anyone. "That's not his temperament," he had said. "He's got enough personal horsepower that he doesn't need to resort to things like that." Later, he acknowledged to the Times, "That's the biggest lie I ever told you." He has also confessed that in 1997 he ordered incriminating documents destroyed in the case of Lisa McPherson, the Scientologist who died of an embolism while under church care. If these men were capable of lying to protect the church, might they not also be capable of lying to destroy it? However, 11 former Sea Org members told me that Miscavige had assaulted them. 22 have told me or testified in court that they have witnessed one or more assaults on other church staff members by their leader. Footnote: the list of those who told me they had been physically assaulted by David Miscavige: Mike Rinder, Gail Irwin, Marty Rathbun, Jefferson Hawkins, Tom DeVogt, Mark Fisher, Bruce Hines, Bill Dendu, Guy White, Mark Headley, and Stefan Castle. Those who said they had witnessed such abuse: John Axel, Marty Rathbun, Janella Webster, Tom DeVogt, Mark Headley, Eric Knutson, Amy Scobie, Dan Kuhn, Steve Hall, Claire Headley, Mariette Lindstrom, John Peeler, Andre Tabayoyan, Vicky Asneran, Jesse Prince, Mark Fisher, Bill Dendu, Mike Rinder, David Lingerfelter, Denise, Larry, Brennan, Debbie Cook, and Lana Mitchell. One witness refused to have his name printed. Other witnesses have been reported in the press. End footnote. Mark Headley, one of those who say Miscavige beat them on several occasions, said he knows 30 others who were attacked by the church leader. Rinder says he witnessed 14 other executives who were assaulted, some on multiple occasions, such as the elderly church president Heber Jentsch, who has been in the hole since 2006. Some people were slapped, others punched or kicked or choked. Lana Mitchell, who worked in Miscavige's office, saw him hit his brother, Ronnie, in the stomach during a meeting. Mariette Lindstrom, who also worked in Miscavige's office, witnessed as many as 20 attacks. "You get very hardened," she admitted. She saw Miscavige banging the heads of two of his senior executives, Mark Yeager and Guillaume Lesevre, together repeatedly until blood came from Lesevre's ear. Tom DeVogt says he witnessed Miscavige striking other members of the staff about 100 times. Others, who never saw such violence, spoke of their constant fear of the leader's wrath. The attacks often came out of the blue, like the snap of a finger, as John Peeler described it. Bruce Hines, who was a senior auditor in 1994, told me that before he was struck, I heard his voice in the hallway, deep and distinctive. Where is that motherfucker? He looked in my office. There he is. Without another word, he came up and hit me with an open hand. I didn't fall down. It was at that point I was put in RPF. I was incarcerated 6 years. Davis admitted that the musical chairs episode occurred, even though the church denies the existence of the hole where it took place. He explained that Miscavige had been away from Gold Base for some time, and when he returned, he found that many jobs had been reassigned without his permission. The game was intended to demonstrate how disruptive such wholesale changes could be on an organization. All the rest of it is a bunch of embellishment and noise and hoo-ha, Davis told me. Chairs being ripped apart and people being threatened that they're going to be sent to far-flung places in the world, plane tickets being purchased, and they're going to force their spouses, and on and on and on. I mean, it's just nuts. The Scientology delegation objected to the negative tenor of the New Yorker queries about the church's leader, including such small details as whether or not he had a tanning bed. I mean, this is the New Yorker. It sounds like the National Enquirer, Davis complained. He wouldn't say what Miscavige's salary was. The church is not required to publicly disclose that information. But he derided the idea that the church leader enjoyed a luxurious lifestyle. Miscavige, he contended, doesn't live on the ostentatious scale of many other religious leaders. There's no big rings, there's no fancy silk robes, he said. There's no mansion, there's no none of that. None, none, none. Zero, zilcho, not. As for the extravagant birthday presents given to the church leader, Davis said that it was tradition for Sea Org members to give each other gifts for their birthdays. It was just obnoxious for me to single out Miscavige. It's not true that he's gotten for his birthday a motorcycle, fine suits, and leather jackets? I asked. I gave him a leather jacket once, Davis conceded. So it is true? I asked. A motorcycle, fine suits? I never heard that, he responded. And as far as fine suits, I've got some fine suits. The church bought those. In fact, he was wearing a beautiful custom-made suit with actual buttonholes on the cuffs. He explained that for IRS purposes, it was considered a uniform. When Sea Org members mix with the public, he explained, they dress appropriately. It's called Uniform K. Davis declined to let me speak to Miscavige. Nor would he or the other members of the group agree to talk about their own experiences with the church leader. I asked about the leader's missing wife, Shelley Miscavige. John Brousseau and Claire Headley believed that she was taken to Running Springs near Big Bear, California, one of the several sites where Hubbard's works are stored in underground vaults. She'll be out of sight, out of mind, until the day she dies, Brousseau had predicted. Like Mary Sue Hubbard. In the meeting, Tommy Davis told me, I definitely know where she is. But he wouldn't disclose the location. Davis brought up Jack Parsons' Black Magic Society, which he asserted Hubbard had infiltrated. He was sent in there by Robert Heinlein, who was running off-book intelligence operations for naval intelligence at the time. Davis said that the church had been looking for additional documentation to support its claim. A biography that just came out 3 weeks ago on Bob Heinlein actually confirmed it at a level we'd never been able to before because of something his biographer had found. The book Davis was referring to is the first volume of an authorized Heinlein biography by William H. Patterson, Jr. There is no mention there of Heinlein sending Hubbard to break up the Parsons ring. I wrote Patterson asking if his research supported the church's assertion. He responded that Scientologists had been the source of the claim in the first place, and that they had provided him with a set of documents that supposedly backed it up. Patterson said that the material did not support the factual assertions the church was making. I was unable to make any direct connection of the facts of Heinlein's life at the time to that narrative or any of its supporting documents, Patterson wrote. The book reveals that Heinlein's second wife, Leslin, had an affair with Hubbard. Interestingly, given Hubbard's condemnation of homosexuality, the wife charged that Heinlein had as well. Even those allegations from Sarah Northrup, Davis continued, mentioning the woman who had been Parsons' girlfriend before running off with Hubbard. He was never married to Sarah Northrup. She filed for divorce in an effort to try and create a false record that she had been married to him. He said that she had been under a cloud of suspicion even when she lived with Parsons. It always had been considered that she had been sent in there by the Russians, he said. I can never pronounce her name. Her actual true name is a Russian name. Davis was referencing a charge that Hubbard once made when he was portraying his wife as a communist spy named Sarah Komkova-Damanov. That was one of the reasons L. Ron Hubbard never had a relationship with her, Davis continued. He never had a child with her. He wasn't married to her. But he did save her life and pull her out of that whole black magic ring. Davis described Sarah as a couple beers short of a six-pack, to use a phrase. He included in the binders a letter from her dated June 11, 1951, a few days before their divorce proceedings. I, Sarah Northrup Hubbard, do hereby state that the things I have said about L. Ron Hubbard in the courts and the public prints have been grossly exaggerated or are entirely false. I have not at any time believed otherwise than that L. Ron Hubbard was a fine and brilliant man. She went on to say, in the future I wish to lead a quiet and orderly existence with my little girl far away from the enturbulating influences which have ruined my marriage. Sarah did live a quiet and orderly existence until her death of breast cancer in 1997. She explained why she made the tapes in her last months of life. I'm not interested in revenge, she said. I'm interested in the truth. The meeting with the Scientology delegation lasted all day. Sandwiches were brought in. Davis and I discussed an assertion that Marty Rathbun had made to me about the OT3 creation story. While Hubbard was in exile, Rathbun said, he wrote a memo suggesting an experiment in which ascending Scientologists might skip the OT3 level, a memo Rathbun says that Miscavige had ordered destroyed. Of every allegation that's in here, Davis said, waving the binder containing fact-checking queries, this one would perhaps be, hands down, the absolutely without question most libelous. He explained that the cornerstone of the faith was the writings of the founder. Mr. Hubbard's material must be and is applied precisely as written, Davis said. It's never altered. It's never changed. And there probably is no more heretical or more horrific transgression that you could have in the Scientology religion than to alter the technology. But hadn't certain derogatory references to homosexuality found in some editions of Hubbard's books been changed after his death? Davis agreed that was so, but he maintained that the current editions are 100% absolutely fully verified as being according to what Mr. Hubbard wrote. Davis said they were checked against Hubbard's original dictation. The extent to which the references to homosexuality have changed are because of mistaken dictation? I asked. No, because of the insertion, I guess, of somebody who was a bigot, Davis replied. The point is, it wasn't Mr. Hubbard. Somebody put the material in those. I can only imagine, Davis said, cutting me off. Who would have done it? I have no idea. I don't think it really matters, Davis said. The point is that neither Mr. Hubbard nor the church has any opinion on the subject of anyone's sexual orientation. Someone inserted words that were not his into literature that was propagated under his name, and that's been corrected now? I asked, trying to be clear. Yeah, I can only assume that's what happened, Davis said. And by the way, he added, referring to Quentin Hubbard, his son's not gay. During his presentation, Davis showed an impressively produced video that portrayed Scientology's worldwide efforts for literary programs and drug education, the translation of Hubbard's work into dozens of languages, and the deluxe production facilities at Gold Base. The real question is, who would produce the kind of material we produce and do the kinds of things we do, set up the kind of organizational structure that we set up? Davis asked. Or what kind of man like L. Ron Hubbard would spend an entire lifetime researching, putting together the kind of material, suffer all the trials and tribulations, and go through all the things he went through in his life, or even with the things that we as individuals have to go through as part of the new religion? Work 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 14, 15, 18-hour days sometimes, out of sheer, total, complete dedication to our faith, and do it all. For what? As some sort of sham, just to pull the wool over everyone's eyes? He concluded, it's ridiculous. Nobody works that hard to cheat people. Nobody gets that little sleep to screw over their fellow man. We came to the section in the queries dealing with Hubbard's war record. His voice filling with emotion, Davis said that if it was true that Hubbard had not been injured, then the injuries that he handled by the use of Dianetics procedures were never handled because they were injuries that never existed. Therefore, Dianetics is based on a lie. Therefore, Scientology is based on a lie. He concluded, the fact of the matter is that Mr. Hubbard was a war hero. I believe everyone on the New Yorker side of the table was taken aback by this daring equation, one that seemed not only fair, but testable. As proof of his claim that Hubbard had been injured, Davis provided a letter from the U.S. Naval Hospital in Oakland, dated December 1, 1945. It states that Hubbard had been hospitalized that year for a duodenal ulcer, but was pronounced fit for duty. Davis had highlighted a passage in the letter. Eyesight very poor, beginning with conjunctivitis actinic in 1942. Lame in right hip from service-connected injury. Infection in bone. Not misconduct, all service-connected. Davis added later that according to Robert Heinlein, Hubbard's ankles had suffered a drumhead-type injury. This can result, Davis explained, when a ship is torpedoed or bombed. Despite subsequent requests to produce additional records, this was the only document Davis provided to prove that the founder of Scientology was not lying about his war injuries. And yet, Hubbard's medical records show that only 5 days after receiving the doctor's note, Hubbard applied for a pension based on his conjunctivitis, an ulcer, a sprained knee, malaria, and arthritis in his right hip and shoulder. His vision was little changed from what it had been before the war. This was the same period during which Hubbard claimed to have been blinded and made a hopeless cripple. Davis acknowledged that some of Hubbard's medical records did not corroborate the founder's version of events. The church itself, Davis confided, had been troubled by the contradiction between Hubbard's story and the official medical records. But he said there were other records that did confirm Hubbard's version of events based on various documents the church had assembled. I asked where the documents had come from. From St. Louis, Davis explained, from the archives of Navy and Military Service. And also, the church got it from various avenues of research, just meeting people, getting records from people. The man who examined the records and reconciled the dilemma, he said, was Mr. X. Davis explained, anyone who saw JFK remembers a scene on the Mall where Kevin Costner's character goes and meets a man named Mr. X, who's played by Donald Sutherland. In the film, Mr. X is an embittered intelligence agent who explains that the Kennedy assassination was actually a coup staged by the military-industrial complex. In real life, Davis said, Mr. X was Colonel Leroy Fletcher Prouty, who had worked in the Office of Special Operations at the Pentagon. Oliver Stone, who directed JFK, says that Mr. X was a composite character based in part on Prouty. In the 1980s, Prouty worked as a consultant for Scientology and was a frequent contributor to Freedom magazine. We finally got so frustrated with this point of conflicting medical records that we took all of Mr. Hubbard's records to Fletcher Prouty, Davis continued. Prouty told the church representatives that because Hubbard had an intelligence background, his records were subjected to a process known as sheep dipping. Davis explained that this was military parlance for what gets done to a set of records for an intelligence officer, and essentially they create two sets. Prouty died in 2001. The sun was setting, and the Dunkin' Donuts sign glowed brighter. As the meeting was finally coming to an end, Davis made a plea for understanding. "We're an organization that's new and tough and different and has been through a hell of a lot and has had its ups and downs," he said. "And the fact of the matter is nobody will take the time and do the story right." Davis had staked much of his argument on the veracity of Hubbard's military records. The fact-checkers had already filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all such material with the National Archives in St. Louis, where military records are kept. Such requests can drag on well past deadline, and we were running short on time. An editorial assistant, Yvette Siegert, flew to St. Louis to speed things along. Meantime, Davis sent me a copy of a document that he said clearly confirmed Hubbard's heroism. A notice of separation from the U.S. Naval Service, dated December 6, 1945. The document specifies medals won by Hubbard, including a Purple Heart with a palm, implying that he was wounded in action twice. But John E. Bircher, the spokesman for the Military Order of the Purple Heart, wrote me that the Navy uses gold and silver stars, not a palm, to indicate multiple wounds. Davis included a photograph of the actual medals Hubbard supposedly won, but two of them weren't even created until after Hubbard left active service. There was a fire in the St. Louis archives in 1973, which destroyed a number of documents, but Yvette returned with more than 900 pages of what the archivists insisted were Hubbard's complete military records. Nowhere in the file is there mention of Hubbard's being wounded in battle or breaking his feet. X-rays taken of Hubbard's right shoulder and hip showed calcium deposits, but there was no evidence of any bone or joint disease in his ankles. There is a notice of separation in the official records, but it is not the one Davis sent me. The differences in the two documents are telling. The St. Louis document indicates that Hubbard earned 4 medals for service, but they reflect no distinction or valor. The church document indicates, falsely, that Hubbard completed 4 years of college, obtaining a degree in civil engineering. The official document correctly notes 2 years of college and no degree. The official notice of separation was signed by Lieutenant J.G. J.C. Rhodes, who also signed Hubbard's detachment paperwork. On the church document, the commanding officer who signed off on Hubbard's separation was Howard D. Thompson, Lieutenant Commander. The file contains a letter from 2000 to another researcher who had written for more information about Thompson. An analyst with the National Archives responded that the records of commissioned naval officers at that time had been reviewed, and there was no Howard D. Thompson listed. The church, after being informed of these discrepancies, asserted, "Our expert on military records has advised us that, in his considered opinion, there is nothing in the Thompson notice that would lead him to question its validity." Eric Voltz and William Siebert, two longtime archivists at the St. Louis facility, examined the church's document and pronounced it a forgery. Footnote: The reader can compare the two notices of separation by going to the New Yorker's posting on Document Cloud, https://documents.newyorker.com/2011/02/notice-of-separation-ron-hubbard/. Gerald Armstrong testified that he had seen a document, either a fitness report or something similar, around the time of the end of the war, that bore the signature of a Commander Thompson, which he believed that Hubbard had actually forged. Church of Scientology, California v. Gerald Armstrong, May 15, 1984. End footnote. Eric Voltz additionally told the New Yorker, "The United States has never handed out Purple Hearts with a palm." He said that ditto marks, which are found on the document provided by the church, do not typically appear on forms of this kind. The font was also suspect, since it was not consistent with the size or style of the times. Voltz had never heard of the Marine Medal, and he took issue with the BR period and DTCH period, VICT period, MEDS period, found on the church document, saying that medals awarded by foreign countries are not listed on a notice of separation, and that they were unlikely to have been awarded to an American in any case. A few months after this meeting, Davis and Feshbach stopped representing Scientology, even though they continued to be listed as the top spokespeople on the church website. Rumor from former members is that Davis blew, but was recovered and once again subjected to sect-checking. Then Feshbach became seriously ill. According to the church, they are on a leave of absence from the Sea Org for medical reasons. They are now living in Texas. When I last spoke to Davis, he said, "I think you should know my allegiances haven't changed at all." He added, "I don't have to answer your questions anymore." Epilogue. If Scientology is based on a lie, as Tommy Davis's formulation at the New Yorker meeting suggests, what does it say about the many people who believe in its doctrine or, like Davis and Feshbach, publicly defend and promote the organization and its practices? Of course, no religion can prove that it is true. There are myths and miracles at the core of every great belief system that, if held up to the harsh light of a scholar or an investigative reporter, could easily be passed off as lies. Did Muhammad really ride into heaven on the back of his legendary transport, the steed Burak? Did Jesus' disciples actually encounter their crucified leader after his burial? Were these miracles or visions or lies? Would the religions survive without them? There is no question that a belief system can have positive, transformative effects on people's lives. Many current and former Scientologists have attested to the value of their training and the insight they derived from their study of the religion. They have the right to believe whatever they choose. But it is a different matter to use the protections afforded a religion by the First Amendment to falsify history, to propagate forgeries, and to cover up human rights abuses. Hubbard once wrote that the old religion, by which he meant Christianity, was based on a very painful lie, which was the idea of heaven. "Yes, I've been to heaven, and so have you," he writes. "It was complete with gates, angels, and plaster saints, and electronic implantation equipment." Heaven, he says, was built as an implant station 43 trillion years ago. So there was a heaven after all, which is why you are on this planet and were condemned never to be free again until Scientology. He went on, "What does this do to any religious nature of Scientology? It strengthens it. New religions always overthrow the false gods of the old. They do something to better man. we can improve man. We can show the old gods false. And we can open up the universe as a happier place in which a spirit may dwell. One might compare Scientology with the Church of Latter-day Saints, a new religion of the previous century. The founder of the movement, Joseph Smith, claimed to have received a pair of golden plates from the angel Moroni in upstate New York in 1827, along with a pair of magical seeing stones, which allowed him to read the contents. 3 years later, he published the Book of Mormon, founding a movement that would provoke the worst outbreak of religious persecution in American history. Mormons were chased all across the country because of their practice of polygamy and their presumed heresy. Smith himself was murdered by a mob in Carthage, Illinois. His beleaguered followers sought to escape the United States and establish a religious theocracy in the territory of Utah, which they called Zion. Mormons were so despised that there was a bill in Congress to exterminate them. And yet Mormonism would evolve and go on to become one of the fastest-growing denominations in the 20th and now the 21st centuries. Members of the faith now openly run for President of the United States. In much of the world, this religion, which was once tormented because of its perceived anti-American values, is now thought of as being the most American of religions. Indeed, that's how many Mormons think of it as well. It is a measure not only of the religion's success, but also of the ability of a faith to adapt and change. And yet, Joseph Smith was plainly a liar. In answer to the charge of polygamy, he claimed he had only one wife, when he had already accumulated a harem. A strange but revealing episode occurred in 1835 when Smith purchased several Egyptian mummies from an itinerant merchant selling such curiosities. Inside the mummy cases were scrolls of papyrus reduced to fragments, which Smith declared were the actual writings of the Old Testament patriarchs Abraham and Joseph. Smith produced what he called a translation of the papyri titled The Book of Abraham. It still forms a portion of Mormon doctrine. In America at the time, Egyptian was still thought to be indecipherable, but the Rosetta Stone had already been discovered, and Jean-François Champollion had successfully rendered the hieroglyphic language into French. In 1966, the Joseph Smith papyri were discovered in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It was soon shown that the passages that Smith translated were common funerary documents with no reference to Abraham or Joseph whatsoever. This fraud has been known for decades, but it has made little difference in the growth of the religion or the devotion of its adherents. Belief in the irrational is one definition of faith, but it is also true that clinging to absurd or disputed doctrines binds a community of faith together and defines a barrier to the outside world. The evolution of Scientology into a religion also resembles the progression of Christian Science, the faith Tommy Davis was born into. Like Hubbard, Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, experimented with alternative ways of healing. Like Hubbard, she claimed to have been an invalid who cured herself. She, too, wrote a book based on her experience, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, which became the basis for the founding of the Church of Christ Scientist in 1879. Far more than is the case with Scientology, Christian Science stands against mainstream medical practices, even though both organizations lay claim to being more scientific than religious. Many religions, including Christian Science, Jehovah's Witnesses, even Christianity, have known scorn and persecution. Some, like the Shakers and the Millerites, died out, but others, including Mormons and Pentecostals, have elbowed their way into the crowded religious landscape of American society. The practice of disconnection, or shunning, is not unique to Scientology, nor is the longing for a religious sanctuary. America itself was founded by true believers who separated themselves from their non-Puritan kinfolk by placing an ocean between them. New religious leaders continually appear, giving expression to unmet spiritual needs. There is a constant churning of spiritual movements and denominations all over the world, one that advances with freedom of expression. One must look at L. Ron Hubbard and the odyssey of his movement against this historical backdrop and the natural human yearning for transcendence and submission. In the late 1970s, I lived for several months in an Amish and Mennonite community in central Pennsylvania, researching my first book, City Children, Country Summer, Scribner's 1979. Their movement had been nearly annihilated in Europe, but in the 1720s they began taking refuge in William Penn's colony, the Holy Experiment of Pennsylvania. Amish life has remained essentially unchanged since then, a kind of museum of 18th-century farm life. The adherents live sequestered lives out of the drift of popular culture on a kind of religious atoll. I was moved by the beauty and simplicity of their lives. The Amish see the earth as God's garden, and their duty is to tend it. The environment they surround themselves with is filled with a sense of peace and a purposeful orderliness. Individuality is sanded down to the point that one's opinions are as similar to another's as the approved shape of a bonnet or the regulation beard. Because fashion and novelty are outlawed, one feels comfortably encased in a timeless, unchanging vacuum. The enforced conformity dims the noise of diversity and the anxiety of uncertainty. One feels closer to eternity. One is also aware of the electrified fence of orthodoxy that surrounds and protects this Edenic paradise, and the expulsion that awaits those who doubt or question. Still, there is a kind of quiet majesty in the Amish culture, not because of their rejection of modernity, but because of their principled nonviolence and their adherence to a way of living that tempers their fanaticism. The Amish suffer none of the social opprobrium that Scientologists must endure. Indeed, they are generally treated like beloved, endangered animals, coddled by their neighbors and smiled upon by society. And yet they are highly schismatic, willing to break off all relations with their dearest relatives on what would seem to an outsider to be an inane point of doctrine, or even the question of whether one can allow eaves on a house or pictures on a wall. As adorable as the Amish appear to strangers, such isolated and intellectually deprived religious communities can become self-destructive, especially when they revolve around the whims of a single tyrannical leader. David Koresh created such a community in the Branch Davidian compound that he established near Waco and aptly called Ranch Apocalypse. In 1993, I was asked to write about the siege that was then underway. I decided not to, because there were more reporters on the scene than Branch Davidians. However, I had been unsettled by the sight of the 21 children that Koresh sent out of the compound shortly before the fatal inferno. Those children left behind their parents and the only life they had known. They were ripped out of the community of faith, placed in government vans, and ushered through a curtain of federal agents and reporters onto the stage of an alien world and who knows what future. I thought there must be other children who had experienced similar traumas. What had become of them? There is a strangely contorted mound in a cemetery in Oakland, California, close by the Naval Hospital where Hubbard spent his last months in uniform. Under an undistinguished headstone rest 400 bodies out of the more than 900 followers of Jim Jones, who perished in Jonestown in 1978. The caskets had been stacked on top of each other on the side of a bulldozed hillside. Then the earth was filled in, grass was planted, and the tragedy of Jonestown was buried in the national memory as one more inexplicable religious calamity. The members of the People's Temple, as Jones called his movement, had been drawn to his Pentecostal healing services, his social activism, and his racial egalitarianism. Charisma and madness were inextricably woven into the fabric of his personality, along with an insatiable sexual appetite that accompanied Jones's terror of abandonment. In his search for a secure religious community, Jones had repeatedly uprooted his congregation. Finally, in May 1977, the entire movement disappeared virtually overnight. Without warning, leaving jobs and homes and family members who were not a part of the People's Temple, they were spirited away to a jungle encampment in Guyana, South America, which Jones billed as a socialist paradise. There, he began to school them in suicide. I learned that not everyone had died in Jonestown. Among the survivors were Jones's three sons, Stephen, Tim, and Jim Jr. They had been away from the camp playing basketball against the Guyanese national team in the capital city of Georgetown. These haunted young men had never before told their stories. One of the privileges of being a journalist is to be trusted to hear such memories in all their emotional complexity. One night I went to dinner with Tim Jones and his wife Lorna. Tim was physically powerful, able to press 100 pounds with either arm, but he couldn't fly on an airplane because of his panic attacks. He wanted his wife to come along because he had never given her a full account, and he wanted to be in a public place so he wouldn't cry. It was Tim who had to return to Jonestown to identify the bodies of everyone he knew, including his parents, his siblings, and his own wife and children, his whole world. He was convinced that if he had been there, he could have prevented the suicides. He told this story, bawling, pounding the table, as the waiter steered away and the other diners stared at their plates. Never have I felt so keenly the danger of new religious movements and the damage that is done to people who are lured into such groups, not out of weakness in character, but through their desire to do good and live meaningful lives. Scientology wants to be understood as a scientific approach to spiritual enlightenment. It has, really, no grounding in science at all. It would be better understood as a philosophy of human nature. Seen in that light, Hubbard's thought could be compared with that of other moral philosophers, such as Immanuel Kant and Soren Kierkegaard, although no one has ever approached the sweep of Hubbard's work. His often ingenious and minutely observed categories of behavior have been shadowed by the bogus elements of his personality and the absurdity that is interwoven with his bouts of brilliance, making it difficult for non-Scientologists to know what to make of it. Serious academic study of his writing has also been constrained by the vindictive reputation of the Church. The field of psychotherapy is Scientology's more respectable cousin, although it cannot honestly claim to be a science either. Freud's legacy is that of a free and open inquiry into the motivations of behavior. He also created postulates, such as the ego, the superego, and the id, that might not endure strict scientific testing, but do offer an approach to understanding the inner workings of the personality. Hubbard's concept of the reactive and analytical minds attempts to do something similar. Jung's exploration of archetypes, based on his psychological explorations, anticipates the evolution of Dianetics into Scientology, in other words, the drift from therapy to spiritualism. There is no point in questioning Scientology's standing as a religion. In the United States, the only opinion that really counts is that of the IRS. Moreover, people do believe in the principles of Scientology and live within a community of faith. What else is required to accept it as such? The stories that invite ridicule or disbelief, such as Xenu and the Galactic Confederacy, may be fanciful or pure space opera, to use Hubbard's term, but every religion features bizarre and uncanny elements. Just consider some of the obvious sources of Hubbard's unique concoction: Buddhism, Hinduism, magic, general semantics, and shamanism. that also provide esoteric categories to explain the ineffable mysteries of life and consciousness. One can find parallels in many faiths with the occult beliefs and practices of Scientology. The concept of expelling body thetans, for instance, is akin to casting out demons in the Christian tradition. But like every new religion, Scientology is handicapped by the frailties of its founder and the absence of venerable traditions that enshrine it in the culture. To an outsider who has struggled to understand the deep appeal of Scientology to its adherents, despite the flaws and contradictions of the religion that many of them reluctantly admit, perhaps the missing element is art. Older faiths have a body of literature, music, ceremony, and iconography that infuses the doctrinal aspects of the religion with mystery and importance. The sensual experience of being in a great cathedral or mosque may have nothing to do with belief, but it does draw people to the religion and rewards them emotionally. Scientology has built many impressive churches, but they are not redolent palaces of art. The aesthetic element in Scientology is Hubbard's arresting voice as a writer. His authoritative but folksy tone and his impressionistic grasp of human nature have cast a spell over millions of readers. More important, however, is the nature of his project, the self-portrait of the inside of his mind. It is perhaps impossible to reduce his mentality to a psychiatric diagnosis, in part because his own rendering of it is so complex, intricate, and comprehensive that one can only stand back and appreciate the qualities that drove him hour after hour, year after year, to try to get it all on the page: his insight, his daring, his narcissism, his defiance, his relentlessness, his imagination. These are the traits of an artist. It is one reason that Hubbard identified with the creative community, and many of them with him. Scientology orients itself toward celebrity, and by doing so, the church awards famousness a spiritual value. People who seek fame, especially in the entertainment industry, naturally gravitate to Hollywood, where Scientology is waiting for them, validating their ambition and promising recruits a way in. The church has pursued a marketing strategy that relies heavily on endorsements by celebrities who actively promote the religion. They speak of the positive role that Scientology has played in their lives. When David Miscavige awarded Tom Cruise the Freedom Medal of Valor in 2004, he praised his effectiveness as a spokesperson, saying, "Across 90 nations, 5,000 people hear his word of Scientology every hour." It is difficult to know how such a figure was derived, but according to Miscavige, every minute of every hour, someone reaches for LRH technology simply because they know Tom Cruise is a Scientologist. Probably no other member of the church derives as much material benefit from his religion as Cruise does, and consequently, none bears a greater moral responsibility for the indignities inflicted on members of the Sea Org, sometimes directly because of his membership. Excepting Paul Haggis, no prominent Hollywood Scientologist has spoken out publicly against the widespread allegations of physical abuse, involuntary confinement, and forced servitude within the church's clergy, although many such figures have quietly walked away. Since leaving Scientology, Haggis has been in therapy, which he has found helpful. He's learned how much he blames others for his problems, especially those closest to him. "I really wish I had found a good therapist when I was 21," he said. In Scientology, he always felt a subtle pressure to impress his auditor and then write up a glowing success story. "Now," he said, "I'm not fooling myself that I'm a better man than I am." The same month that Haggis's resignation from the church had become public, United Artists, Tom Cruise's studio, terminated Haggis's development deal. I asked if the break had anything to do with his resignation. Haggis thought for a moment, then said, "You don't do something that obvious. It'd be a bad PR move. He added, they'd run out of money, so we all knew we were being kicked out. Recently, he and Deborah decided to divorce. They have moved to the same neighborhood in New York so that they can share custody of their son. Deborah has also left the church. Both say that the decision to end their marriage has nothing to do with their renunciation of Scientology. On November 9, 2010, the next 3 days premiered at the Ziegfeld Theater in Manhattan. Movie stars lined the red carpet as photographers fired away. Jason Begay was there, and he told me that he had taken in Daniel Montalvo, the young man who lost his finger in the church book publishing plant. Montalvo had recently blown from the Sea Org. He was 19 years old. He's never seen television, the actor marveled. He doesn't even know who Robert Redford is. Nazanin Boniadi, who has a small part in the movie, was also there. Haggis had given her the role after learning what had happened to her after the church had engineered her match with Tom Cruise. Naz's story was one of those that made me realize I had been lied to for a long time, that I had to leave and do so loudly, Haggis later confided. After the screening, everyone drifted over to the Oak Room of the Plaza Hotel. Haggis was in a corner receiving accolades from his friends when I found him. I asked if he felt that he had finally left Scientology. I feel much more myself, but there's a sadness, he admitted. If you identify yourself with something for so long, and suddenly you think of yourself as not that thing, it leaves a bit of space. He went on, it's not really the sense of a loss of community. Those people who walked away from me were never really my friends. He understood how they felt about him and why. In Scientology, in the ethics conditions, as you go down from normal through doubt, you get to enemy, and finally, near the bottom, there is treason. What I did was a treasonous act. The film did poorly at the box office. It had the misfortune of opening to mixed reviews on the same night that the last installment of the Harry Potter series premiered. Haggis had to close his office. It looked like another bleak period in his career, but he followed it by writing a screenplay for a video game, Modern Warfare 3, which would go on to set a sales record, earning $1 billion in the first 16 days after its release. I once asked Haggis about the future of his relationship with Scientology. These people have long memories, he told me. My bet is that within 2 years, you're going to read something about me in a scandal that looks like it has nothing to do with the church. He thought for a moment, then said, I was in a cult for 34 years. Everyone else could see it. I don't know why I couldn't. Marty Rathbun divides the people who leave Scientology into three camps. There are those who reject the teachings of L. Ron Hubbard entirely, such as Paul Haggis, and those who still believe entirely but think that the church under David Miscavige has taken Scientology away from the original true teachings of the founder. There is a third category, which he has been struggling to define, that includes those people who are willing neither to swallow all the dogma nor to throw away the insights they gained from their experience. Hubbard's life and teachings are still the guideposts of their lives. It wouldn't stick if there wasn't a tremendous amount of good it did for them, Rathbun says. He's been studying the history of other religions for parallels, and he quotes an old Zen proverb. When the master points at the moon, many people never see it at all. They only look at the master. Rathbun has been counseling Scientologists who leave the church, and because of that he's been subject to continual monitoring and harassment from the church. His computers have been hacked, and phone records have been stolen. A group of squirrel busters moved into his little community of Ingleside-on-the-Bay near Corpus Christi in order to spy on him and drive him away through constant harassment. They wore video cameras on their hats and patrolled the neighborhood in a golf cart or occasionally a paddle boat. This lasted for 199 days. That tactic didn't work because his neighbors rallied to his support. Many other defectors have been harassed and followed by private investigators. On a sweltering 4th of July weekend 2011, a group of about 100 independent Scientologists gathered at a lake cabin in East Texas. Rathbun and Mike Rinder had organized it. A few courageous swimmers were leaping off the dock, but rumors of alligators kept most people on the shore. A brief, powerful storm rolled through, driving everyone to shelter. One of the attendees was Stephen Foth, known as Sarge, a Vietnam veteran who had gotten into Scientology in 1975. He is a slender man with haunted eyes. "It was one of those sudden things that happened," he explained. "I was looking for something, especially spiritually." He had run across an advertisement on the back of a magazine for Hubbard's book, Fundamentals of Thought. Soon after reading it, he flew to Washington, D.C., and took a 3-day workshop called Life Repair Auditing. "I was blown away." He immediately quit his job. "I sold my house and bought the bridge." Soon a church official began cultivating him, saying, "LRH needs your help." Foth joined the Sea Org that November. He became head of Hubbard's security detail and was with the founder on his Creston Ranch in his final days with Pat and Annie Broker. In early 1985, Hubbard became extremely ill and spent a week in a hospital. Foth was told it was for pancreatitis. "I didn't find out about the strokes until later," he said. After that, Hubbard stayed mostly in his Bluebird bus, except when he came out to do his own laundry. Foth might be shoveling out the stables, and they'd talk. 6 weeks before the leader died, Foth hesitantly related, Hubbard called him into the bus. He was sitting in his little breakfast nook. "He told me he was dropping his body. He named a specific star he was going to circle that rehabs a being. He told me he'd failed. He's leaving," Foth said. "He said he's not coming back here to Earth. He didn't know where he'd wind up." "How do you react?" I asked. "I got good and pissy-ass drunk," Foth said. "Annie found me at 5 a.m. in my old truck, Kris Kringle, and I had beer cans all around me. I did not take it well." I mentioned the legend in Scientology that Hubbard will return. "That's bullcrap," Foth said. "He wanted to drop the body and leave, and he told me basically that he'd failed. All the work and everything, he'd failed." I had heard a story that Foth had built some kind of electroshock mechanism for Hubbard in the last month of his life. I didn't know what to make of it, given Hubbard's horror of electroshock therapy. Foth's eyes searched the ceiling as if he were looking for divine help. He explained that Hubbard was having trouble getting rid of a body thetan. "He wanted me to build a machine that would up the voltage and basically blow the thetan away. You can't kill a thetan, but just get him out of there, and also kill the body." "So it was a suicide machine?" "Basically." Foth was staggered by Hubbard's request, but the challenge interested him. "I figured that building a Tesla coil was the best way to go." The Tesla coil is a transformer that increases the voltage without upping the current. Foth powered it with a 12-volt automobile battery and then hooked the entire apparatus to an E-meter. "So if you're on the cans, you can flip a button and it does its thing," Foth explained. "I didn't want to kill him, just to scare him."
"Did he try it?"
"He blew up my E-meter. Annie brought it back to me, all burnt up." This was just before Christmas, 1985. Hubbard died a few weeks later of an unrelated stroke. The believers are still waiting for his return. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief by Lawrence Wright. Text copyright 2013 by Lawrence Wright. Production copyright 2013, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.